Good afternoon. This is Liz Elliott in for Bob Krueger with Thought for Food for September 2023. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It is intended for an audience who is blind or has a print impairment, but hopefully it will be of interest to everyone. Dates to remember this month begin with VJ Day on the 2nd, when Japan signed a formal end to World War II. The 4th is Labor Day, the 11th is Patriot Day, and National Day of Servants and Remembrance. On the 14th in 1814, Francis Scott Key wrote the words to the Star Spangled Banner. The 15th is POWMIA Recognition Day. On the 17th, the U.S. Constitution was approved. That happened in 1787. And Mr. Bob Krueger read for the reading service for the first time on September 12, 1985. According to a new study, between 4 and 5 minutes of vigorous physical activity each day can greatly reduce the risk of cancer in people who have been previous non-exercisers. The research conducted at Australia's University of Sydney found that participants who engaged in vigorous, intermittent lifestyle of physical activity for an average of 4.5 minutes each day reduced their risk of physical activity-related cancer incidents by 32%. Those who exercised over 3 minutes but under 4 each day limited their cancer risk by 17 to 18%. Physical activity-related cancers include bladder, stomach, lung, and kidney cancers. The term vulpa is used to define in the report as brief and sporadic bouts of vigorous physical activity during daily living. It can include anything from power walking to carrying heavy grocery bags and engaging in energetic household chores. This study tracked 22,308 adults who were non-exercisers. They averaged 62 years old and wore activity monitors for 1 week. Meanwhile, researchers studied their medical diagnosis and hospitalization records across the last 6 to 7 years. We know the majority of middle-aged people don't regularly exercise, which puts them at increased cancer risk, but it is only through the advent of wearable technology like activity trackers that we are able to look at the impact of short bursts of incidental physical activity done as a part of daily living, said the study's lead author. It's quite remarkable to see that upping the intensity of daily tasks for as little as 4 to 5 minutes a day, done in short bursts of around 1 minute each, is linked to an overall reduction in cancer risk for up to 18 to 32% of cancer types linked to physical activity, he said. We need to further investigate this link through robust trials. It appears that vulpa may be a promising, cost-free recommendation for lowering cancer risk in people who find structured exercise difficult or unappealing, he said. For those like me, enough said, get a move on. You've likely heard that you are what you eat, but a new study suggests what you eat also has something to do with who you are, genetically speaking. Researchers have identified nearly 500 genes that appear to directly influence what someone eats. These insights could help improve personalized nutrition to boost health or prevent disease, they say. Some genes we identified are related to sensory pathways, including those for taste, smell, and texture, and may also increase the reward response in the brain, said research leader Joanne Cole. She's an assistant professor in the Biomedical Information Department at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Because some of these genes may have clear paths towards influencing whether someone likes a food or not, they could potentially be used to create sensory genetic profiles for fine-tuning a person's dietary recommendations based on foods they like to eat, Ms. Cole added in a news release from the American Society for Nutrition. For the study, the researchers used data from the UK Biobank, which has information from 500,000 people, to do a phenome-wide association study. That enabled them to identify genes more strongly associated with diet than with any other health or lifestyle factor. The foods we choose to eat are largely influenced by environmental factors such as our culture, socioeconomic status, and food accessibility, Ms. Cole said. Because genetics plays a much smaller role in influencing dietary intake than all the environmental factors, we need to study hundreds of thousands of individuals to detect genetic influences amid the environmental factors. The data necessary to do this hasn't been available until recently. It can be challenging to identify diet-related genes. What people eat also involves other factors, including income, body weight, and high cholesterol, the study's authors noted. The researchers applied methods to tease out direct efforts of genetic variants that affect diet apart from indirect effects, such as a person having diabetes for genetic reasons and thus eating less sugar because of the condition. The UK Biobank's detailed genetic health and socioeconomic data allowed the investigators to test individual genetic variants for associations with thousands of traits. They could then eliminate indirect gene variants more strongly associated with conditions like diabetes. The study's authors found around 300 genes directly associated with eating certain foods. They also noted almost 200 genes linked to dietary patterns, which group various foods together, such as overall fish intake or fruit consumption. The study showed that the dietary patterns tend to have a more indirect genetic effect, meaning they were correlated with a lot of other factors. This shows how important it is to not study dietary patterns in a vacuum, because the eating patterns' impact on human health may be completely mediated or confounded by other factors. In the future, Ms. Cole would like to see if a genetically modified diet could aid weight loss. Could nutritionists use a person's genetics to adapt the flavor profile of a weight loss plan to improve staying with the plan? Ms. Cole presented the findings at the annual meeting of the American Society for Nutrition. Findings presented at medical meetings should be considered preliminary until published in a peer-reviewed journal. While much of this story seems way over my head, I'm glad to know that some scientists are working to help us try to stay healthier longer. Last month, Mr. Kruger shared with you an article written by B. Wilson, whose food columns appear in the Wall Street Journal. And today she asked the question, is fruit getting sweeter? These are so sweet I can't manage very many. A friend at Mr. Kruger's table one summer evening a couple years ago. She wasn't talking about dessert, but a bowl of glossy dark red fresh cherries. Mr. Kruger bit into another luscious cherry with its sweet juices and realized that she was right. Those fruits were so sweet, it was as if they had been pre-sugared. And here Mr. Kruger notes that sweet cherries really aren't anything new. You only have to read Elizabethan love poems with their references to cherry lips to see that sugary sweet cherries have been a summer treat for hundreds of years. And Mr. Kruger says that the sweet cherries of his childhood, which he and his sister used to dangle over their ears like earrings, were much less sweet than today's cherries. Some of them were hardly sweet at all, which makes it all the more exciting when you happen upon a super sweet one. Is modern fruit bred to be sweeter than in the past? The short answer is yes, though the longer answer is more complicated. Some of the most powerful evidence that fruit is sweeter than before comes from zoos. In 2018, it was reported that Melbourne Zoo in Australia had stopped giving fruit to most of its animals because cultivated fruit is now so sweet that it was causing tooth decay and weight gain. The monkeys at the zoo were weaned off bananas onto a lower sugar vegetable-based diet. Among fruit breeders, the word quality is now routinely used as a synonym for high-end sugar, though firmness, color, and size are also considerations. In 2010, an article looking at ways to enhance the sweetness of fruit using molecular approaches, a group of Korean plant scientists wrote, in general, the sugar content of many fruits are now higher than before owing to continuous selection and breeding. Modern apple varieties, the scientists noted, were on the average sweeter than older varieties. Breeding isn't the only reason that modern fruit is sweeter. There's also climate change. Researchers from Japan found that since the 1970s, with rising temperatures, Fiji apples, which are already a sweet variety, have become significantly sweeter and softer. The lead researcher, Toshioko Sugiura, said that if you could taste an apple harvested 30 years ago, you would feel the difference. It's sometimes claimed that the sweetness of modern fruit is not due to higher sugar content so much as the fact that bitterness and sourness of wild fruit has been steadily bred out of it. There is a grain, but only a grain, of truth in this. Studies of wild apples do indeed suggest that some ancient varieties were just as rich in sugar as today's Pink Lady or Honeycrisp. The difference is that there was a much wilder variation in sugar content across wild apples, whereas the modern supermarket apple seldom drops below a level of sweetness. Even now, not all fruits are so sweet as others. The sugar content of fruit is measured using something called the Brix scale, which refers to the percentage of sugar by mass. Modern cherries are routinely 20 degrees Brix or more, while most of the peaches on the market, at least in Europe, range from 9 to 12 degrees. According to plant breeder and scientist Marco Cirilli, this means that the average peach still has a flavor somewhere between harsh and tasteless, though peaches continue to ripen at room temperature. Mr. Cirilli is part of an Italian project called MESPS, which is developing new, higher sugar peach varieties. He tells me that in trials, they have succeeded in growing peaches with a Brix score as high as 25, but this isn't easy to reproduce. The sweetness of fruit depends not only on how it's bred, but also on growing conditions. More sun means more sweetness. Higher yield means lower sugar content when it's harvested. The longer the fruit stays on the tree, the sweeter and fuller tasting it is. Jim Cooper, an apple farmer in England, tells me that modern apples are picked so early that even if they're bred for sweetness, they often don't develop their full character, be it sweetness, aromatic qualities, or intensity of flavor. Many of the subtle aromas never develop in fruit that is harvested too early. Mr. Cooper laments the fact that many people will never taste the strawberry hint in a really ripe English Worcester pearmain, a type of heritage apple. With the rise in sweeter and blander fruit, our expectations of how fruit should taste have also changed. Whether we're talking about apples or peaches, Europeans and Americans tend to favor fruits that are both acid and sweet, whereas in Asia, the most popular fruits are intensely sweet with hardly any acidity. Mr. Cirilli tells that in Asian countries, the honey flavor of low-acid peaches is much appreciated, while the European consumers prefer peaches that are slightly acidic, with a Brix score of over 15. All around the world, the common thread is what people want from fruit is sweetness. Many of our old dessert recipes need to be adjusted to take into account the fact that fruit is sweeter than it used to be. Rosalind Rathaus, a cooking teacher who has been making apple strudel since the 1970s, says that the difference is that she no longer uses any sugar in her recipe, just a bit of cinnamon. A few years ago, Mrs. Rathaus, who runs Cookery House in London, realized what the modern varieties of dessert apples, no extra sugar, was needed to make a delicious strudel. In a way, the rise of consistently sweeter fruit in our lifetime has been a triumph of plant breeding. After all, it's a rare person who would seek out bitter grapes, astringent apricots, or watery melons if they could have sweeter ones instead. But the sweetness of modern fruit is not without its problems, especially for people who have diabetes, who have to be careful to moderate their intake of higher sugar fruits such as pineapple. Fruit that is bred sweeter also tends to be lower in the phytochemicals that make it healthy. Health aside, maybe the real problem with modern fruit is that it has become yet another sweet thing in a world awash in sugar. Even grapefruit, which used to be bracing bitter, are sometimes as sweet as oranges. Fruit that is bred for additional sweetness, as opposed to aroma and texture, denies in some of the contrast and rarity of life. If you've never tasted a sour cherry, how can you fully appreciate a sweet one? Thanks again, Mrs. Wilson. The bagel shop that began as a park pop-up, then a farmer's market favorite, now has its own storefront. Owned by Isaac Henrian, Isaac's Bagels opened recently in Durham at 1003 West Chapel Hill Street. The menu currently includes a handful of open-faced sandwiches like smoked salmon, cream cheese, and the works, a brightly seasoned tomato with dill cream cheese, and something on the sweeter side, ricotta and ham. Unlike its wildly popular farmer's market tent, Isaac's also offers bagel and cream cheese sandwiches and breakfast classics like bacon, egg, and cheese on a bagel. The bagel options include most of the classics. Expect everything: sesame, poppy seed, onion, salt and pepper, and plain. Cream cheese options feature an herby dill scallion, sweet fig and honey, spicy burnt jalapeno, and a fiery Szechuan chili, plus smoked salmon and capers blended in. Isaac's doesn't have any space for indoor seating, but does plan to offer some outdoor tables. The shop also serves coffee, cold beer, and espresso drinks. On his first day in this location, he said the only problem he had was running out of paper in the machine printing order tickets, forcing him to run down the block to Grub and borrow a roll. It definitely wasn't a finished project. We still have a lot to add, but I was elated, Mr. Henrian said. Of the opening service, one of the things I love about this place is that we're in the same neighborhood where I started. We saw a lot of friendly faces of people who have supported us through 2.5 years. Mr. Henrian started Isaac's Bagels as something of a pandemic pivot. The former computer scientist saw his restaurant job disappear to COVID that initially shut down dining rooms in 2020. He started baking on the side and finally produced a bagel that he never got sick of. For months, he took bagel orders on Instagram, handing them out in a Durham community garden, then grew into a residency at Queenie's Restaurant in downtown Durham. Now Isaac's is one of the most popular stands at the Durham Farmers Market. The bagels are delivered in waves by a bright orange van, wheeled on pallets through the crowds and landing on a table where there's already a line waiting. Mr. Henrian says that Isaac's sells about 2,000 bagels each Saturday at the farmer's market, where they will remain a vendor. In preparing to open, Isaac's Bagels launched a Kickstarter campaign aimed at raising $40,000 to help cover construction costs. Fans blew past that goal, chipping in more than $57,000 to help bring the bagel dreams to life. The Isaac's menu will expand in the future, adding more pastries and bagel sandwiches, such as a whitefish salad. One of the Kickstarter levels offered backers the chance to create and name a seasonal sandwich in the shop for a $750 donation. The first one will be developed soon. I know it'll be delicious, he said. Isaac Snell joins a triangle bagel scene that punches above its weight. Only a few years ago, there seemed like there were no great bagels to be found. Now Raleigh has Benchwarmers Bagels, Cary has Big Dom's Bagel Shop, Durham has Everything Bagels, and Chapel Hill has Brandwines, feeding all the bagel frenzy. Isaac's Bagels will be open 4 days a week, Thursday through Sunday, from 8 a.m. to noon most days, and from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturdays. These days and hours will be expanded in the future as the shop becomes more established. Kale and asahi have long held the crown as some of the most nutrient-packed produce available at the grocery store. But after years of their domination, there might be a new superfood in town. The CDC just crowned watercress as the best produce for your health. The agency assigns nutrition density scores to fruits and vegetables based on their concentration of essential vitamins and minerals. According to Prevention Magazine, watercress was the only vegetable to earn a perfect score of 100, trailed by other veggies like spinach, chard, and beet greens. It has more vitamin A and potassium than lettuce and more vitamin C than an orange. Captain James Cook even used it to cure scurvy in his crew while sailing around the world. Watercress isn't exactly a go-to green for many people. It's known for its pungent flavor and scent. Its scientific name, Nasturtium officinate, is Latin for nose twister. Still, it has been a widely used ingredient for thousands of years. It was a staple in ancient Greek, Persian, and Roman cuisines and was served at the first Thanksgiving Day. On top of being food, it's been used for medicinal purposes in Europe and Asia for millennia. Many people wouldn't think of watercress as a proper vegetable. However, it grows in bodies of fresh water like streams and ponds and is closely related to cabbage, kale, and radishes. But there's so much of it in wet environments, some regions of the world consider watercress to be a weed. Despite its abundance, it can be hard to find in many grocery stores and only available at specialty places like Whole Foods. So the next time you see it while shopping, stock up and find some good recipes. Americans are eating their burgers, fries, and nuggets at home, their cars, or at the office, increasingly anywhere but at the fast food restaurants. At McDonald's and Burger King, booths are often empty. Customers pick up their orders and head out. People sitting at tables are sometimes workers on break. Dine-in customers now represent less than 10% of visits in most U.S. McDonald's restaurants, according to chain franchisees, compared with around one quarter of domestic sales before the COVID-19 pandemic. Across U.S. fast food chains, diners ate 14% of orders in the first 5 months of this year, less than 21% before the pandemic, data fresh from market research firm Circana show. In June, diners ate 14% of their fast food orders in the restaurant's dining room, compared with 22% in 2019, Circana said. The COVID-19 pandemic accelerated a shift toward to-go that was already underway. Owners serving the bulk of their orders to go found that they were more profitable and efficient to run, needing less maintenance work and staff. Big companies began increasing investment in drive-thrus and online ordering. You don't necessarily need big dining rooms that you needed in our traditional restaurants, McDonald's CEO Chris Kanczynski said. McDonald's and other chains are developing new restaurants centered around drive-thru and carry-out with very little or no dine-in option. Still, fast food restaurants are reluctant to give up on their dining room. Major chains want their restaurants to look modern, inviting, and fresh. McDonald's, for example, pledged to spend billions of dollars to help U.S. franchisees pay for digital kiosks, modern furnishings, and other improvements beginning in 2017. The chain now expects U.S. owners to renovate dining rooms every 10 years. Franchisees say they often pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to install new furniture and fixtures and discard the old. Dine-in orders at McDonald's are a significant part of its U.S. business, and consumers' perception of the brand has improved with the investments, the company said. Burger King is spending millions of dollars to encourage U.S. owners to renovate their locations, though operators have to pick up much of the costs. It's absolutely critical, said John Kobza, CEO of Restaurant Brands, who own Burger King. One of their spokeswomen said that a remodel results in an average of 12% sales increase in the first year. Restaurant franchisees, who run the majority of restaurants for chains like McDonald's and Burger King, largely support the shift to dining away. It is often cheaper and less labor-intensive to pack food into bags to be eaten elsewhere than to keep a dining room clean. Some operators say that the fast food business is permanently shifting toward drive-through and to-go orders. Mr. Kruger recently had a sandwich at a McDonald's, and he saw people getting their orders in a bag and leaving. For more than 40 years, the Berkeley Cafe kept its funky watch in downtown Raleigh, offering refuge for the beer-deprived and cheeseburger-starved, providing off-kilter entertainment for a buttoned-down town. It occupied the same three-story brick tower off Nash Square, skinny as a milk carton, soaked in decades of Pabst Blue Ribbon that had housed one Raleigh restaurant, cafe, or another for more than a century. And in its wilder, earlier years, when Raleigh's downtown drew only a handful of night owls, you might find a wrestling tournament in the back room in which the winner would bash his opponent over the head with a watermelon. Then Raleigh got respectable, and real estate developers discovered its downtown crowds. And for the past year, the venerable cafe has lived under constant threat of an office tower planned next door. A neighbor potentially rising 36 stories. But in mid-August, the steadfast Berkeley announced it will start a new chapter downtown, occupying a building just around the corner, preserving its spunky presence downtown. Opening in 1980, the Berkeley meshed with a grittier Raleigh in its earlier decades, providing a safe space for hipster misfits and a form of entertainment that required a bib and safety goggles. Its wrestling matches drew grapplers who climbed into the makeshift ring, toting trash cans full of weapons, including umbrellas, plungers, and a toaster, all of which figured in the competition. The Berkeley opened a stage to amateur comedians with names like Slam and Sam, metal bands with names like Slugnet, and blues musicians with names like Steady Rollin', Barb McGolin. The Squirrelnut Zippers played there on their way to hot jazz fame, and Texas Roadhouse legend Billy Joe Shaver once crooned to a beery crowd. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Thought for Food. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Liz Elliott, reading for Bob Kruger, and we both read to you for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long, until next time. If you have a question or comment, please call us at 919-832-5138.